CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 167, with Professor Dr. Burkhard Dick, pioneering ophthalmology innovations and global leadership, from the president of the ESCRS.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest. My dear friend, Professor Dr. Burkhard Dick. You know,
Nice to meet you.
Oh, hold on. I'm getting an echo. I hear my echo in your computer.
Okay.
Maybe you can turn my voice down just a little.
Yes.
And then you can still
hear me. Okay, let's try this out.
Much better.
Is it better?
Perfect. Okay, I'll do that again.
Good.
Welcome back to the Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest. My dear friend, Professor Dr. Burkhard Dick. He's president of the ESRS. He's also professor and chairman of the Department of Ophthalmology there at Bochum, University of Bochum in Germany. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me with me. It's really a pleasure to meet you.
Now, people obviously have heard your name for decades now, but may not realize just how hard you work. So I was very impressed that you not only do cataract refractive surgery, you've pioneered a lot of things with glaucoma surgery and MIGS. You even do hundreds of vitrectomy surgeries here.
So you've got the whole eye, front to back. That's right. But the good thing is that, it took time, of course, during my fellowships. But the good thing is that in the German system, you can then educate all the head physicians and train them up to the next level and handle their complications if they don't feel comfortable with it.
Right. And I looked up, you've had fellows at your program from 44 countries, which is amazing.
Yeah, that's right. All over the world. But it's a gift to educate. And that's what drives me too in this field. That is you see people growing up from the very beginning or at a certain stage, and they work hard on their performance, and you try to level them up to the next level, let's say this way. And then they become also maybe a professor or a head of a bigger clinic or a very successful practice. And that is something that is really rewarding to me.
For sure, to mentor so many people who then go on to mentor their own students.
Right, yeah.
You've been a pioneer in a lot of things. One of the earlier things you did were probably really embraced femtosecond laser.
Yeah, so I was fortunate to be one of the first in worldwide. We started with the Catalyst from, at that time, OptiMedica, which was then bought by J&J, but we started really at the beginning. That's really from the scratch, to be honest. The devices were not that good as they are now, of course, but they had excellent people, like engineers from Stanford, top people, and they were really here in Bochum also to even, improve the technology. And I mean, the devices right now are superb in this regard, and they really deliver.
Right, they've changed a lot. I still remember the first femtosecond laser we had, which was very slow, not as accurate.
Oh my God.
More prone to having capsule runoffs.
Yeah. And we changed also what we found in histology, that the settings they provided as a, let's say, general starting point, so to say, were not good. So, for example, we changed vertical spot spacing and increased this a little bit, for example. That had a tremendous effect on the stability of the capsulotomy. And that was histologically also proven, but it was really like black and white in terms of performance.
Yeah, I saw a paper of yours where initially you had 4 runouts out of, let's say, 1,500 cases. But then after,
Yeah, so also it was in terms of the fragmentation, for example, we found out that you really end up, and that's especially for the harder cases, the cases are easier to perform because you have already a split situation where the nucleus is already divided, so you don't need to groove or something like that. You can just initially crack the lens into quadrants or even whatever you name it. And also we found that the need of ultrasound can be reduced tremendously. And this is really great for eyes with compromised endothelium, like Guttaia or this Fuchs dystrophy and these cases, they really benefit from it. I wouldn't say that standard cases, but especially the tougher cases, they are really benefiting from this technology.
Yeah, you published a paper where a large portion of cataract patients can have zero ultrasound energy.
Yeah, exactly. And that is you see it. I mean, that's the beauty of our field of ophthalmic surgery. You see directly after surgery, and next day latest, how good you were. So if you really performed well, then, you know, the cornea is crystal crisp, clear, and no decimate membranes, nothing. Yeah, right. So no issues, and that's the big, the good thing. We really get the result immediately.
Sure. You also are pioneering some of the challenging cases, like a Marfan syndrome case or dislocated crystal lens. I think that's a case where a femtosecond laser is a game changer.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it's not possible with every femtosecond laser. So that means, for example, that the lens is dislocated, and of course, then that means you have to dislocate in per intention the right. capsulotomy, and that's not possible with all systems. So, but if the system allows this, then you get rid of the edge of it, and you're not in the zonule apparatus. That means that the capsulotomy is already performed, and then you can recenter using a 1E, for example, tension ring. You know this with the leaflet that's going sure. out, and can recenter the lens, and that is perfect also for pediatric cases.
Right, for Pete's right. case especially, where a rexus can be quite challenging.
Yeah, yeah. So I've performed for 10 years when I was in Mainz, which is the capital of a state in Germany, close to Frankfurt. I had to operate on all pediatric eyes at that time, and I prepared myself well in terms of the devices to use and whether we are using Tripin Blue, for example, to reduce the elasticity of the capsule. But still, whatever you do, you often end up with too large capsular axis. And here you have a device that really delivers on spot. And that is, of course, that you have to take into account the age factor. So the younger the patients, the greater the enlargement. That means you target for smaller, and you end up with a larger capsulotomy, but it really delivers. And this formula, which we published and we optimized slightly also, is used now worldwide by Singapore and so many other centers who also treat pediatric cataracts with the femtosecond laser. And I would say God really made this laser system technology for pediatrics, because they really benefit. It's amazing, really. Because you also, what you can do, and that is something I really value most, is the fact that you can also perform a posterior capsulotomy, mm-hmm. which is exactly centered to the anterior capsulotomy in terms of centration, but also in terms of the diameter as well as the location. And now comes the most important point. You do not need to perform an anterior vitrectomy. So do you leave the anterior hyalur surface intact? And that means that you won't have any PCO, which is always a challenge. And anterior vitrectomy, as the Academy results that have recently been published and presented at the last AAO in November, if you have to perform an anterior vitrectomy in pediatric cases, you significantly increase the incidence of retinal detachment, but also glaucoma and other things.
Sure.
But the older people, the older generations, they haven't seen that. And they say, they are always claiming, like Robert Stakeman and many others are saying, okay, that's because we are performing on a routine basis anterior vitrectomy in these pediatric, very young eyes. And that has some impact in terms of the overlaid load and decrease in angle facilitation, the Schlemm's canal, by glycosaminoglycanes, and that are more or less obstructing the meshwork. And there's a secondary glaucoma in these eyes, which does not happen if you perform an anterior as posterior capsulotomy and then implant, for example, a bag in the lens that you're using the Bose capsule leaflets, and which is are then inserted in the groove, outer groove of the optic, for example. Yeah, and that's the beauty of for pediatric, the use of the femtosecond laser in pediatric cataracts.
I think it's a great advantage for that, for sure. Especially what you said, how you take the patient's age into account. If it's a very young child, you make a smaller capsulotomy, which will then, because of elasticity, enlarge a little bit. So you have that
form. Yep. Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, and then you also have FLERO, FLERO, femtosecond laser enhanced refractive outcome.
Yeah, that's was an idea that was not my idea. That is by Wendell Scott and Shachar Tauber. They are both at Mercy, as you know, and they are doing a femto on a routine base and every patient. And the idea was that we also take into account the intraoperative OCT. Mm. Yeah, and here you have an exact determination of, for example, of the angle, but also of the outer periphery of the capsular bag, so the equator. Yeah. And that is interesting in terms of predicting the ELP, the holy grail, down the road in terms of decreasing the deviation from the target reflection. And we found if we just use, for example, the Barrett True K formula, that we especially are very good in the very short eyes, where it is most important. And sure. Also what happened is that the surgeons changed the IOL power for the benefit in terms of decreasing the deviation from the target refraction. And that is the first paper has already been published. And the second is on its way, also showing that there is an improvement if we integrate our power calculation, use AI, and also include our intraoperative live OCT.
Right. Yeah. The equatorial lens position where you can measure with the femtosecond laser, with the imaging, but we don't know it in the pre-op visit in the clinic.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I think it's a good. This is the future, no doubt. Yeah, this is will take some time that the companies have the permission to use this intra in the laser system. That has something to do with of course the who is responsible for what here at this point, because the company only can make recommendations. But if you can do this on spot intraoperatively, that's perfect reconfirmation. Let's say it this way.
Right, and then obviously now with these newer technology lenses, hitting our target of emmetropia is so important to get top performance out of those lenses.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then now recently, paper just came out from the ESCRS classifying the premium lenses. Tell me about that.
Yes. Yeah, that's based on a functional vision working group. And, we have, of course, ANSI and we have ISO norms and they describe the lenses already well. But the problem, what I see, I'm not sure if this is the same in US, but we have so many lenses worldwide. And the problem I see is that all these lenses withstand, let's say, some additional optical benefit, that these lenses, are named by the companies. Right. Like, let's say, X-ray shaped, aberrometry guided, whatsoever. And honestly, I have no clue what's behind the lens, what the lens down the road will deliver. So it's a mess because we have more than 100 lenses in Europe, for example. And the lenses right now are classified, whether they are what they are, by the company, mm-hmm. which is... It's a difficult thing that say it this way because some, if you look at the optical bench or MTF curves, classify them as the companies as an EDOF lens. But from the optical bench, they are a clear multifocal and vice versa, and so that is really irritating. And I heard a lot of colleagues were saying, okay, how can we get rid of this? And so the idea is that we have a monocular. Using a monocular defocus curve to see the performance, yeah, as a first step. It's not the end of the story. It's just the first step into the right direction because this is evidence-based. That means you take all the clinical trials, start with, of course, MTF curves, etc. But down the road, the intention is also to include, for example, PROMs, contrast sensitivity, but also, for example, of course, dysphotopsias. Yeah, but the first approach is done. And it's so we have divided the lenses into they are divided into categories. We are talking about simultaneous vision IOLs, and some are partial and some are full depth of field. Yeah, mm-hmm. And this agreement is with the ASCRS, but also with APA SCRS and South Americans, so LATAMs. So it's a global consensus that is just published in the Orange Journal, Journal of Cataract Refractive Surgery, in the March issue, where we published the global consensus on how we name these lenses. And that is, it looks at the first glimpse, it looks difficult in terms to adopt. But if you look a little bit closer, you see that we are talking about nearly three groups of lenses. One partial DOFI that where you have you are below 2.3 diopters in terms of performance and depth of field, and these are extended partial simultaneous vision IOLs with an extended field. But then we are at the multifocals, and then that can be also called full depth of field lenses. And these full are more or less the smooth ones and the continuous ones. You can forget about the bifocals that are also in, because nobody is implanting bifocals any longer. Yeah. So more or less we have three groups and that's it. And what we did just recently at the German Society of Cataract Refractive Surgery, I took an overlay, like a glossary, on top of it, so that in German, and in other languages, this will also be taken, of course, in English, but maybe in English also with another glossary, which we use under ourselves at the Congress, and also can use at the same time without having anglicisms or something like this with the patients. And that is really, really cool. Very easy now in terms of communication, not only between us as surgeons, but also with our patients, using the same language, but not this. I think this is the current language which is used for scientific purposes, yeah, to have everybody aligned that we specifically know exactly what we are talking about. But we need a glossary on top of it, which is very easy then to use. And that's the background of this so-called functional vision working group, which is an international group and takes into account global experts. And I think we are on the right way to have our own word here and our own classification. And you can use IOL Evidence, which is an app and yes. is for free. For example, there you can exactly see your specific lens and how this is exactly categorized. And also, that is the work of Joaquim Fernandez, a colleague from Spain, who's is very engaged in this field. Also, you can also, for example, look if your patient has some comorbidities, how well your IOL would fit for that particular person. And everything very evidence-based.
I think it's amazing. I think it's fantastic that we as ophthalmologists are now making the classification.
Yeah.
Instead of relying on the marketing department.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I could not agree more with you, Dave.
And then also with the ESRS, there's a nice, huge database. The EuroQuo, European Registry of Quality Outcomes in Cataract Refractive Surgery, which is now millions of eyes.
Yeah, that's right. So, which is one of the big assets of the ESRS is to have all the data coming in of the different centers. They collect the data preoperatively, intraoperatively, document everything in terms of complications, etc. Similar to what you are doing in the US, which is the IRIS registry and all these things. But the intention here is also to derive means and have a mean in terms of the quality of the centers, but also derive, let's say, interesting aspects we were not aware of. And that is that then leads easily to, and we are always astonished more and more how many things are not proven, are not evidence-based, because there was not a good clinical trial covering this particular aspects. So for example, what ESRS has done, and you know this of course, but how do we treat patients with diabetic retinopathy? And also in terms of patients who have already, let's say, macular edema in the context of diabetes. And this all was part of a prospective randomized comparative trial, has been published already. But this provides, I think, every surgeon a good base how to handle, treat these patients in terms of, do I have to give them steroids or non-steroids? Right. Do I have to apply maybe a subconjunctival injection of some steroid depot or something like that? And what would be the benefit for the patient down the road? And I think that all this comes from registries, which provide us a good hint and what needs to be investigated and might be of interest for our broader community.
Right. I think it's so important to have that long-term follow-up also, where we can see these sequelae that we're not normally seeing.
Yeah, fully agree with you. Absolutely.
Yeah, a lot of important data coming from that. Tell me, you're going to be president of the ESCRS now.
Yeah.
And ESCRS has become probably my favorite cataract and refractive meeting in the whole world.
Thank you.
It has grown so much. What are your plans for ESCRS during your presidency?
Yeah, the good thing is that the term is for 2 years. That is really good for that, because then you can move a lot of things within the society. And the good thing also, what you need to know is that the ESCRS is a completely charity organization, UK-based, and has a great intention in terms of charity efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one thing that I introduced, what you have for a long time already, and David Cheng, I know, is very engaged, but the whole ASCRS is very active in humanitarian work, which we are also concentrating mostly on sub-Saharan area, so South Africa. But I introduced, together with the support, of course, of many others, but it was my idea that we have also a humanitarian award, which is awarded with 100,000 euro for a good project. And fun fact is that for the very first time, 67 nominations came in.
Wow.
For more than 40 countries. And we have now a committee that is evaluating all the applications. And this will be part of the opening ceremony in London, where we have our annual congress then, to award a certain person, an unseen hero who's dedicating all his time to charity work in order to get rid of the greatest burden worldwide, and that is cataract, as a blinding cause for blindness. It's unbelievable, but that's fact. So this is one humanitarian award. Then, of course, the globalization of the ESCRS, which is taking a very good shape. That means the societies have to reach out to us, and this occurs. So, for example, we have now, as a non-EU, ESCRS is Europe, of course, but we have now a lot of non-EU affiliated societies. One of them is Taiwan. So Taiwan is completely affiliated with us, and they are all very proud. They have to work a lot of paperwork to come to that level, to be, the only difference they have in terms of membership, that they cannot vote, because we are in Europe and we want to keep Europe as a political entity decided by our own, so to say. But also where we have is Brazil, that is the effort of Filomena Ribeiro, and Filomena with Portuguese, of course, and then which is then the language in Brazil, did a great job, and we are so happy. We had in Copenhagen, we had 300 doctors from Brazil. They made a great photo on an elevator, so that everybody is on the picture. That was really impressive, yeah. And then we have most recently affiliated, this based on my work, the Egyptian Society. So Egypt has an Egyptian Ophthalmological Society, and then they have two sub-specialties. So the first step was that they write an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding. And then we have a clear partner, and that partner affiliated successfully with us. So the Egyptian, which is more than 80 million people, theirs is a very, very strong group, is affiliated. And then, for example, the Emirates are also successfully, also the Saudi Arabians are now officially affiliated. And also, fun fact, is Mexico.
Mexico
is also affiliated now with ESCRS. And because I think they see the things similar in terms of values we are standing for, and also in terms of guidelines and all the things that we have developed now, that the nomenclature, as you mentioned, and trials that we could better do internationally rather than in European-based only. And these things are now on the global, more global track, so to say. That's another aspect of my presidency. And then, of course, also what I changed is and was very successful, the winter meeting, which was in the past more for education, was now, we had this 2 weeks ago in Helsinki, was completely focused on presbyopia. So 3 days, only presbyopia. From the morning to the evening, only main symposia, everything you can imagine and everything you need to know on presbyopia. This will continue as the next winter meeting. So a focus meeting with a particular topic, and that's it. Only focusing on that. Worldwide experts only coming for that particular topic. Nothing else. So no glaucoma, nothing.
That's great.
But that was a great success. We had really a great mood there and top experts from worldwide. And I think this was a great success, and we will continue on that pathway. So I, of course, I have many other things to talk to, but that is these are parts of what I think would be great. And what you may enjoy at the eSERIS in London will be that we have a 3D microscope showdown.
Wow!
So all the different microscope setups will be shown by experts who are using this on a daily routine. The room will be completely prepared for this particular. That means you have need a special projectors, a special setup, including a special hard and software that is capable in delivering all the data that needs to go. And then no copper, but really glass fiber is needed for that. But also sound, etc. That will be great. So we will have digital days, including an AI summit, and also for all the affiliated society, including the Americans. There are 3D microscope surgical sessions with glaucoma, cataract, and refractive.
Wow, amazing. ESCRS has just grown so amazingly big. Tens of thousands of people attend. I think the last meeting, it was 120 companies attended this meeting in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
And about the same for the year before in Barcelona. So certainly as an American, it's actually my favorite meeting worldwide for cataract refractive. And I encourage my American colleagues, just go. You will love it. You'll learn so much. It's really a fantastic meeting. And you're innovating so much. I'm so looking forward to the 3D event.
But it has also to do with people like you. Yeah, because you are a great educator, and I learn a lot from you, including, of course, my hero, Bobby Osher.
Oh, the best.
And I think educators like you, who really are so good in teaching and educating people, and that is something which is a great asset of the eSERIS. Of course, there are few others too that also are fantastic in this regard. But I mean, I'm also grateful to you that you come over, and with the long travel and the time zone change and everything that comes along with it. And I know that also for your family, this is a distractor, but and your dog, and so everything that you give up for that. But I appreciate that that you're also providing us with some great content.
Although I'm going to have to ask the organizers to give me a bigger room. In Copenhagen, we filled every chair, 500 seats, plus there were 300 people outside the door who couldn't get in.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
So, we've got to get it bigger. And I will also be at the Taiwanese cataract refractive meeting this July.
Yeah, perfect. Great.
Yeah,
so the hospitality is awesome, by the way. You have to spend at least one day further. They have a very nice arrangement at the sea there, and that is something very special for them.
Oh, fantastic. I'm looking forward to it. You, for ESRS, also got the sustainability project, the SURE project. Sustainability Healthcare Research Award.
Yeah, so we are part, of course, of iSustain, and that is was driven and is driven by David Chang. And we have to really appreciate his efforts in bringing all the societies together. And SURE is something that, you know, finding innovative approaches, how that could be also scaled and also used by others. And there are so many fantastic ideas that easily can really have a great contribution to the sustainability aspects. And with the cataract surgery as the most often performed procedure, I think it's a great start, and we can definitely also contribute.
Yes, for sure. I think if I look at my own clinic, for one cataract surgery, the amount of garbage we create, And then you multiply that by thousands of surgeries a year.
Right.
It's just huge.
Yeah.
So absolutely. I think that's important thing for sure is to be able to be more sustainable, to do a greener cataract surgery.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And the YOs, they are extremely active in this regard in Europe. I'm sure that they're also in US, but it is really impressive how creative they are and challenging sometimes also, which is good. I love that.
Right. I mean, the young ophthalmologists obviously are the future of our field. They are super. So bright and have such great ideas. And I love their enthusiasm.
Yeah, me too. So just to give you an idea, we have the Arena type, which is an audiovisual setup. And they have for London created something that's amazing, I tell you, really amazing. They spent hours to create that. And so it will be a blast in London for sure. And everything was all only created by the YOs. So they are amazing in this regard.
Yeah, I think they're just really the future of our field. And what I like also is how they're incorporating all the new technologies. Like the Arena program I participated in Copenhagen was fantastic. Very different than any other lecture. And then also these are the ones who are now integrating new AI projects in technology.
Yeah. So we will have an AI summit, including the YOs, and also parliament style. That means really like in UK, parliament style with debates, really with people standing up. And we have our speakers, also professional speakers, that they take care of the that everything is handled well in the sense of UK. But that will be a great thing. But we have a lot of other awards also at the ESRS. That is the Clinical Research Award. That is for the big projects, like sure. What we are doing now is the use of the low torics, for example, as a multi-center start trial to see if they are of benefit at all. If we treat with low torics with toric IOLs, so yes. Toricity treatment, but also internationally, for example, because in Europe we don't have that many patients who are for cataract surgery, post-keratof refractive surgery use of lens with some optical benefit. Mm. Yeah, so you have a lot of patients. Brazil has a lot of patients, so that's great. The beauty of these international society sponsored trials. Then we have PRAs. So if a surgeon has an idea, and that is in the range, let's say between 50 to 100,000 euros, that is supported if the idea is good, and that is decided by an independent group. It's anonymously, and then we have the systematic research awards. That is 10,000 euro for a meta-analysis or a systematic research award topic that is conducted. So many awards that people can apply to.
Wow, that is fantastic. So many opportunities.
Yeah.
And I love how ESRS is so inclusive and welcoming. So you're drawing people from all over the planet to come to that big meeting, which is great.
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the biggest or most important efforts. That's was introduced by Philomena, of course, with the BOSS group, which is extremely active. And fun fact is, and that's something I'm personally proud of, that in Helsinki we had a balance in terms of speakers and also moderators, panelists, etc., of 47% females.
Okay, well,
yeah, that's nearly a balance 50-50. And the future of ophthalmology is female, no doubt.
For sure. I think ESRS is doing amazing things. Now, part that's so hard to believe for me is you do all the work for the ESRS. You do thousands of surgeries here. You had a whole department. And you have a prolific amount of research. I looked at your publication. Your group in Volcom, you're working every 10 papers every week.
No, not every week, but they're extremely active. I'm very proud of it. So the clue was, or the greatest decision was first to create a research group that's completely on the basic research, so experimental research, that is headed by Professor Stefanie Joachim and Professor Sabrina Reiner. And they have a group of 30 employees who are only performing purely experimental research. For example, the use of laser-induced refractive index shaping in cornea with a femtosecond laser, with a low-energy femtosecond laser, which has a great potential. You know that this has been started already in the past by Scott McRae in Rochester.
Sure.
I think we have a significant change in this approach. So they are doing the research really in animals with the second generation femtosecond laser system, for example. But they are also doing a lot of research in retina, in dry eye, in glaucoma, and so forth. And then another important step was to have a clinical research department. So that's completely dedicated, entirely dedicated to clinical research. So about 15 to 17 clinical trials are active. And then three or four rotated out and new come in. And they are self-funding. So doctors, optometrists work there and they take care of the trials, for example. Yeah.
Well,
and then, of course, because of the region, we have to cover everything in terms of patient care here, because we have to care a maximum care. That means also including oncology and orbit surgery and all these things. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is good.
I was surprised, though, even at your university, you're treating the retinopathy prematurity, the premature babies, even.
Yeah, yeah. But one of the biggest assets is also, you know, at the same level, and that's great, we have neurosurgeons, maxillary surgeons, etc. So we work often together in tumor surgery, etc. Of there are, yeah, these that kind of things that is really rewarding, because you see a lot how other surgical facilities and disciplines are working. They have sometimes a very different approach, and you communicate with on the tumor board with them and so forth. So that's is really rewarding in terms of the exchange you have then. And one thing I would like to mention is that we need to take care in ophthalmology that we don't publish photos where we just in the OR without mask or something like that, push a button or something like that. This is a little bit irritating for other disciplines like neurosurgeons and others, because they perceive us then as someone who's not really doing surgery or something like that. Yeah, so that is something what I dislike to see. Sometimes people are advertising themselves in the OR without any, you know, protection or something like that. We need to take care, because we are still doing surgery, and that is important surgery, as we all agree. But in terms of our perception in to our other fields, that is an important recommendation I have.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, you've got to take it very seriously, and remember that you're a surgeon first.
Yeah.
Even if our surgical field is very tiny. Now, you wrote a really great book too. You wrote a book about cataract surgery difficult situations, published I think 4 years ago. What a fantastic book. That must have taken a long time to put together.
Yeah, but that was guided by Jorge Alio and of course Bobby Osher, and that was indeed a difficult project, because well, every article was peer reviewed by two different reviewers, which I have not done before, but it's good. That means we really have top people, but they are critically seen and get a review on what they have to even do better. And one difficult thing was also to integrate all the videos from Bobby Osher. I think there are more than 220 excellent videos in that book, the linked. But of course, Bobby wanted to secure his copyright on these books, on these videos. But when everything went well down the road, so I'm extremely grateful that I had the chance to work with these two legends on this book. And by the way, you were missing in that regard.
Oh,
as a contributor,
I have too many. As you know,
you are busy extremely.
Don't have enough time in the week.
Yeah, it's that's right.
Country. But one thing we both make time for, and I'm so proud of, is weightlifting.
So is the way what?
Lifting weights, exercising with
the heavy weight. No, you are my superstar. So what I love is to exercise with you. Next time when we have the chance to spend time together, we have to continue on that. And I think that is also for mental aspects. If you have to concentrate for more than several hours, I think it's good to be in a wealthy state physically. And that also contributes to your mental strength. And so exercise like you and I is of great importance, especially as surgeons often have back problems. as we know, is one of a very important issue that you sit correctly, and sometimes patients move and then you're sitting in an awkward position, and to take care of this is of greatest importance, I would say today.
Yeah, I think you've got to be a surgical athlete for sure.
Yeah.
And I think it helps a lot. For me, I have zero back pain, zero neck pain. I attribute that to the heavyweight.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
And contrary to what some people think, if you're doing heavy weights in the gym, it'll take away from your micro fine surface skills. That is not true.
No, I agree. Absolutely not.
Yeah. And you, when we worked out this last time together, I was impressed. You pushed me to do a little bit heavier than I normally do. So,
well, that's something of my mentality, let's say it this way. Yeah. So asking others for more, even more on top of the 100% is one of my nature. But that's something that I think is others value that much, because they see, okay, there's always room for even more improvement.
Right. And since we'd worked out that last month, I use the new heavier weight. I'm using the 22.
Wow. Wow.
For the curls. Yeah, exactly. So I can just do it. It's not easy, but I can do it.
Super.
So it's fantastic. Yeah, you've been big into sport though your whole life, whether it's playing football or tennis or everything.
Yeah. Soccer was one of the greatest sports, but tennis is also great. And now jogging and other sports, yeah, including, of course, physical exercise.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to have that physical longevity.
Yeah.
Maintain this so we can keep helping patients for as long as we can.
Yes. And well, with your robotics you are inventing now, or pushing hard, maybe we can put some more years on top of it.
Yeah. Well, people have a misconception. The robot's not going to replace you. It's going to make you a better version of yourself.
Okay. Is it really true? Because I heard that there are two different approaches. One is with one system that is really improving you, like the Da Vinci, where you have haptic feedback and you just, you can do things that are manually really demanding. And then another approach where just the robot takes everything and takes over everything. But correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not that much in the field.
There can be a balance. So for example, in keratorefractive surgery, if you take the one extreme, you can say, well, if I do trans PRK, I'm only stepping on a pedal. But no, that's not true.
No, agree.
All the surgical judgment and the decision making and how you do it, that's all very important. And so, but then if you look at another case, like you use a femto for tens of thousands of cataracts, it doesn't make you a worse surgeon, it makes you a better surgeon.
Nine, right, agree.
So I think a robot's going to offer you the same kind of thing. When I did the first 10 eyes last year, I drove the robot. I'm in control. But the robot can also rescue me, detect things ahead of time. It's fast. The reaction time. You know, human reaction time. If you were an F1 race car driver, your reaction time is maybe 150 milliseconds.
Yeah.
The robot's 5 milliseconds. It's beyond human.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you operate, you see the robot, you see in 3D with the 4K monitors, the robot gets that data too, plus the OCT scan real time, and it always knows where's the gaps. So imagine you can program the robot to say, no matter what I do, don't let my phaco tip get less than 10 microns from the posterior capsule.
Mm-hmm.
And it will not let that happen.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's really promising. It sounds like very futuristic, but listening to you, it gets more and more real, to be honest.
But it's real. The trial was done October of last year. In El Salvador, we did the first 10 eyes. And boy, the engineers are the true geniuses. I know doctors are smart, but engineers is another level.
Nice. So keep on with the good work, Uday.
Right. So, no, I think that it is the future. We have to embrace it. The same way the femto came out, you embrace it. Now, with the femto, we talked a little bit about refractive index shaping. Now, this is such a great idea. I heard of this many years ago where they say you can do refractive index shaping on an acrylic IOL.
Yeah.
Now we can do it on the cornea.
Yeah.
Perhaps we can even do a presbyopic femto treatment on an intact human crystalline lens.
Yeah.
So when do we see these things?
That's something that needs to be, that's research that is done. I don't want to promise anything because down the road, what is always a question will be in terms of long-term effect. There's no doubt that this can be achieved for a certain period of time, but what about the endurance? So how long will this last, this effect? So my prediction is if this lasts at minimum 1 year, then it will be successful.
Right. So you talked about the winter symposium though for ESRS. You had it all about presbyopia, which I think is for us is kind of the holy grail, especially when I became age 50 and presbyopia happened to me. I couldn't believe it. So, I mean, what were the kind of key takeaways from that presbyopia meeting?
So, we had for our main symposia, we had a presbyopia dialogue session. I think that was a great format that wasn't used in our field at all. You know, in the winter meeting, we test out new formats. And that means we have, you have, for example, what we did is one talk on just the medication, but not for 8 minutes or something like that, really 20 minutes.
Okay.
All trials, all aspects, and where we are from a basic point of view. That means experimental, why there needs to be an anti-inflammatory drug, including this treatment and all the different approaches. And then another talk also for a longer period of time on all the clinical data that are existing. Mm. And then sufficient time to discuss all these things. Yeah. So not these, you know, gosh, 8 minute maximum talks, sometimes 4 or 6 minutes or something like that. You take your time, you cover everything, and then discuss everything together. And that's with time. Yeah. And I think that was really a nice approach, which is often left or is not existent at congresses, that because everybody is in a hurry and just only for a few minutes and that's it. So really spending time and dedicating all these things. And a lot of things are happening in presbyopia treatment. It's unbelievable. So it's amazing how many drugs are coming up in our field. But I'm still skeptical about the acceptance in the field also and on all these stuff. I mean, you have experience with Vuity and others, just to mention one. There's a lot of stuff going on in that field, definitely. For example, what is the status of the ELP changing technologies for in terms of adjustment postoperatively beyond light adjustable lens technology and all these, as you mentioned, for example, also there were talks on femtosecond laser treatment in the natural lens in terms of treating elevating the elasticity of the lens, but also one on lasing into the natural lens, clear lens in patients instead of refractive lens exchange, lasing a small aperture mask into the lens.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So a prospective trial. All these things you would miss or will not have at Congress because you are so busy. And here you have more time for this. And then it's dedicated to these particular approaches. Yeah.
Well, I like the idea of having a 20-minute discussion because of these meetings. I find the discussion back and forth is the most valuable, much better than the five-minute talk about a topic.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And especially, you know, long-term talk on purely basics, long-term all the clinical data, and then everybody's on the same level.
Yeah.
And then you start discussing on that, the different approaches, also with an outlook. Yeah. So we try out new formats, let's say it this way.
I like that it's a great format. The discussion is my favorite, for sure. Do we know what the topic will be for the next winter meeting?
Yeah, so the intention, but now there's a little question tag, to be honest, is to go to Cairo.
Okay.
Yeah, but with the war that's currently very close to that area, it's not because Egypt is safe in terms of traveling, etc. But what happens is that insurance, for example, in terms of terror attacks or something like that, raises tremendously. And also other aspects come to play. So right now we have not yet finally decided to go to Cairo. But we have to very soon. We have to decide whether we go. And the topic I selected for the next winter meeting is myopia.
Oh, fantastic! You definitely must invite our colleagues from Asia then.
Yeah, but also Ken Nishal and others from US and so many experts worldwide. And it's a really important field. It's a burden.
Oh, yeah, it's becoming more and more of a worldwide burden. Incidence of myopia is just skyrocketing now worldwide.
Skyrocketing.
So that's it. So do we know where? So this fall, it'll be in September in London.
Exactly.
Do we have a location for next year's meeting?
Yes, but I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that where we'll go for the summer meeting. But winter meeting, as I said, is intended to be in Cairo.
Okay,
the decision will be made very soon, in a few weeks. And that, of course, will be communicated immediately.
So my last question for you, we've been talking almost 1 hour.
Is unbelievable. Time flies with you, as always.
You, we're having fun. What would you want your lasting legacy to be as president of ESRS?
And within the ESRS, what I would love is charity. Yeah, charity is the greatest gift. You know, we have received from our profession so much already, gratefulness from patients and other fields. But to give to our peers, but also to patients in need, that is the greatest gift in my life, and that is something I will focus on.
So increasing the amount of charity that the ESRS is doing, like you said, sub-Saharan Africa is one of the main locations.
Yeah. And also making people visible who are just, you know, not on the stage, but doing a lot of great work to educate others to perform surgery in all these fields.
Well, I look forward to that award presentation there at the ESRS.
Me too. I will have to hand it over.
Well, thank you. I want to say thank you for taking the time to talk with us on our podcast.
Oh, really, come on, Nude. It's a pleasure. The pleasure is on my side. So thank you. And keep on with the great work you are doing. It's unbelievable. And you're impacting so many people in a very positive and great way, not only educative, but also from a human character point of view.
I'm trying my best. It's not easy.
No, you are perfect, really. Keep on with this good.
Thank you, my friend. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to working out with you again soon.
Time well spent with you. Thank you so much.
Yes, for sure. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Character Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Wherever you find a podcast, you find our podcast. Plus, of course, we have a new Character Coach video every single day. And now check out our sister channel, retinarounds.com, for retina videos and retina podcasts. So until next time, catch you later.